Hello, and thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. My name is Mark Ward. I'm a senior research analyst at the ISF. And in this podcast, we're talking about a European Commission project on cybercrime that the ISF is deeply involved with. And here to talk about the aims of that research project and what it's got up to are Arunoshi Singh and Bruce Page from the services arm of the ISF. Hello, Arunoshi, and hello, Bruce.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
And also here is Rocio Della Cruz, a partner at law firm BPE, who specializes in information law, governance, data protection, and privacy, who will be able to give us a legal perspective on cybercrime and policy. Hello, Rocio.
Hello, Mark. Hello, Bruce and Arunoshi. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for helping us out. So just to get things started then, over to Bruce and Arunoshi, if you could just give us a quick overview of this project, how it came about, how the ISF is involved. The name of the project is CC Driver, and it's looking at the drivers of cybercrime, what prompts people to fall into those kinds of lives, to make those choices. So yeah, if you can give us an overview just to start with, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. Well, this is, as you point out there, Mark, a European Commission project. It was started in May 2020 and will run for 3 years, so finishing up in May 2023. And the reasons for getting that started and under the Horizon 2020 investment program from the European Commission was so many of the activities related to cyber crime, cybersecurity, etc., are really after the fact. It's trying to fix problems that have occurred, namely breaches, incidents, data invasion, you know, loss of privacy, etc. And this project is an effort to try to understand, well, what are the roots and causes? What causes people to commit cyber crimes to begin with? And of course, once having sorted out some of those important topics and hopefully results of the research, to initiate programs to try to get out ahead of and try to create fewer cyber criminals at the end of the day. So the research team ISF is a part of comprises 13 partners from a whole bunch of different backgrounds. There's legal people, there are law enforcement agencies, national cyber security centers, and so on, as well as a variety of research firms, and of course, from all over Europe as a European Commission project. So that's where things have kind of come from, and we're now 2.5-ish years into this adventure.
Yeah, it sounds pretty ambitious because there's a lot of cyber criminals, I guess, and I would imagine as well, part of it is trying to coordinate work because there's probably different initiatives in different European nations that try to tackle these things piecemeal, and there isn't that coordination. So is that the other part of it, just trying to get people to all think about things
in
the same
way? That's right. And you're starting to get into some of the findings of this research project. But ultimately, cyber crime, we kind of thought and recognized during the course of the research, is a pandemic, just like the global pandemic, health pandemic, that has been sweeping the world these past few years. It's similar in many ways, largely invisible and could infect anyone at any time from any source, et cetera. And so it's an intractable problem from a lot of different perspectives, but indeed requiring a coordinated response in ways that organizations, countries, individuals have not been really needed to work together in this kind of way before.
Yeah, I think thinking of it as a pandemic is it struck me as really interesting because I've had COVID twice, but I've been hit by cybercrime way more times than that. So, and I'm sure most people are the same. Just their experience of cybercrime is, I've caught that bug quite a few times.
Sure. And does just, Rocio would probably chime in, the disparity between the different levels of legal protection or non-protection across the European Union, different levels of penalties for a similar crime in different jurisdictions is all part of the problem. And hopefully something that we can help to start to recognize and hopefully fix.
Yes, that is correct. And even though from a European perspective, we've seen this, and even international, but we've seen this necessity not only will but necessity to harmonize approach and to cooperate. And we've seen some examples in the Budapest Convention on cybercrime, for example, that now there is an additional protocol that has been signed up by 22 countries recently, just to discuss and to try to harmonize the level of fines, the also the classification of each cybercrime action within a scope that is similar as well. And even though we have been, from a European perspective, these conversations for 20 years now, because the type of crime and action that caused this criminal offense changes and evolves so quickly, and cyber criminals progress and they are always one step ahead of the rest of us, then when the each country does the best attempt to implement these basic standards that are agreed within a European context, then each country and each jurisdiction does it in a slightly different way. And yes, that's something that it's been part of the work from a European perspective to try to harmonize, but it's really difficult and it's still a challenge because each country comes from a different culture in terms of how this criminal offense has been dealt with, different type of courts dealing with them, and then of course it's in the end, even if you have a range penalty like 2 to 10 years, you know, of prison or some administrative fines, each court will deal with it in a slightly different way, even if you set up the criteria. And you will still see some tendency in some countries to be more strict, even though these standards have been agreed. But hopefully, all the effort that that the European Union is doing to try to fix this issue, because I've seen criminal networks trying to avoid certain countries very cleverly, you know, to try to avoid being subject to those jurisdictions if they can. So and that's something that shouldn't happen.
I remember writing about various crimes, the cyber crimes, breaches, attacks and things like that. And there was a definite sense that in some countries, they were the only reason those bad guys were doing them or routing them through that territory was because they knew it wasn't illegal in that space. Certainly seen that in the past. And I guess there's as well some people who are beyond Europe who are very happy to do it because it isn't criminalized at all in those places as well. Yeah, but Bruce, is the progress on this then? Because I know, I guess you're in the next stage of this now, drawing up those policies, and is that, you know, the European nations trying to get, you know, trying to make a difference here, trying to get those policies harmonized? Do you see?
Well, yes, and there are a number of outputs of the CC Driver program at this point, and I'll maybe walk through what's been done up until now. The ISF was leading one of the several work streams in CC Driver. We led a gap analysis and compare and contrast of the cyber crime legal frameworks in 8 different countries across Europe, because as Rosia has pointed out, these vary widely, and so this opens opportunities to exploit those differences by the very clever community of cyber criminals. So we identified it and codified. These are the kinds of differences and made some recommendations about some harmonization that might find as a result. Another really important thing that the CC Driver Consortium has produced is probably the first ever large-scale survey of cyber criminals. So through some very clever sampling techniques, the University of East London, one of the other partners in this CC Driver Consortium, found and questioned 8,000 cyber criminals, which were in the 8 same countries that we did the legal framework, the gap analysis of, with the intent, of course, to understand, do those differences in the legal frameworks have any difference in incidence among creating a greater tendency to cybercrime? Or on the other hand, are there more effective legal frameworks in preventing young cyber criminals from developing? So very interesting research. In addition to which, there are other work streams that are developing specific monitoring and reaction tools for law enforcement agencies. Those will be submitted through ANISA for use by the European Community law enforcement agencies, and a variety of, let's say, awareness events to make people aware that there's, you know, greater, I guess, more work to be done in this area.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's never ending. But I'm curious about those 8,000 criminals. Were they people who are behind bars, or were they hanging out on the dark web? Or, yeah, I'm curious about if you have any info about where those people were. Right. It's got to be like, I mean, it has to be said, there's
they're
no
hiding
lack
under
of,
hoodies somewhere.
cyber criminals. But I suppose because it's called CC driver, so I guess you've got a good sense of what makes people, I mean, it's, what makes people fall into a life of cybercrime, because I guess some people think, hey, it's the money, I just want more money. But it's not always that, I guess. And some people become not accidental, but they realize they have become a cyber criminal. And you know, is that as well, I guess, what you're trying to get at?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the pathways into cybercrime is there are many of them, and some accidental, as you've just pointed out. But part of the need, I think, is that we've identified through the research and some of the recommendations that have been made, is to provide viable alternatives to a life of crime, find positive ways for some of these individuals to use their skills for fun, for profit, for social status, for some of the other things and kind of reasons and drivers, psychological and other, that drive them into lives of cybercrime or hobbies of cybercrime. Rosia, maybe you have some other observations on this as well.
Is it like, yeah, is it, thank you. Is it like when we used to target hackers to now become experts on carrying out penetration tests and these sort of things? Mm-hmm. So they change their cybercrime criminal lives into another function by where they use their skills in a different way in which they don't commit an offense.
Yes.
But I guess you mean on a wider now scheme, not only hackers,
yeah,
but also people who does phishing, people who does, that's very interesting.
It is. And what we found also is that there's ought to be or should be a series of efficient handoffs between different stakeholders in society, among governments, law enforcement, people in education, rehabilitation programs, etc., should all be working together, essentially. And that was one of the things that we contributed as part of our research as the ISF. Aranoshi, maybe you could build on that a little bit about what was in the ISF set of recommendations for the world at large.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the second half of our output for this project is building a policy toolkit based on the gap analysis that we built out in the first half. And one of the major things that sort of come out of that, alongside examining the other research that our partners have done in the consortium, is that when you have law enforcement agencies and policymakers having trouble defining the parameters of cybercrime and the specific offenses and that differing across borders, that trickles down into the people who find themselves falling into it. And that's why education awareness is such a big part of it, because I think one of the things that was found was that people aren't always necessarily going into cybercriminality as an intentional, purposeful decision, but can fall into it without knowing exactly what they're getting involved in or just how legal their actions are, which is why it's important, especially at the youth and vulnerable groups level, to be having widespread education on the dangers of it, what exactly you could be falling into.
Yeah, I certainly had experience of that when, again, sort of working for the media and writing about usually kids who start messing around at school or trying to knock their mates off Xbox or, you know, gaming sessions and things like that. And they're just messing about. They don't realize what they're doing, but they build up some skill. some social capital around it, and then yeah, it just becomes, you know, something they make money at, and all of a sudden they've got the police knocking on the door. Literally, I think in some cases where they have, I think the I can't remember but the UK police certainly had quite a big prevent program where they literally knocked on doors, sat down with parents, and said, "Did you know what your child was doing?" And then I think that was quite a good way to nip some of that in the bud. But it's very resource intensive. So yeah, if there's other better ways to get at that, then
For sure. I think on the internet, it's very difficult sometimes to see the consequences or the reality of what you're doing, especially as a young person who's grown up on it, especially playing games. There's a gamification aspect as well. So that disconnect between decision and result, I think, can be a driver as well. So these are all the sorts of things that in developing our policy toolkit for safety driver and some of the other outputs as well that we're keeping in mind, because it's not like other crimes. There's a lot of different other factors to consider in terms of what drive people to make these decisions. I don't know if I would even call it a meaningful decision in every single instance, right?
No, I think you're right. I think there was one very telling quote from a school kid who was literally just messing about doing things at their school. And he said that they tried to stop things, but realized it was too late. It was just kind of like, yeah, that was the point at which. And that he was being interviewed as part of a weekend away organized by the police. And I think to your point, Bruce, trying to get people to use their skills in a more productive way, just make them realize that, yeah, actually, you know, this all that time behind the keyboard definitely can, you know, give you a better quality of life, and you know, it can be helpful as well.
Yeah, for sure. Well, one of the directions we were trying to explore, not uniquely by any means, but is the idea of, well, what can be done to try to minimize the incidence of these cyber crimes, prevent them from, you know, growing on unabated. And part of the answer to that, I think, is that what makes an effective law? I mean, are there laws that can be more or less effective? And if so, well, what characterizes the more effective ones? Rosia, do you have any views on that?
Yes, and I'm so fascinated about the idea of preventive crime and working on prevention. We've been involved in campaigns to prevent the commission of the crime, which would be like the second stage. So the criminal is already setting the network, and I've been witnessing and being involved and defending victims from phishing attacks, in which, again, like 15 years ago, this was like someone gets the password of the bank accounts, they get the money, but of course, if they get the money, there is a track of who is getting the money, so they involve other people by offering fake jobs, remote working jobs, which were already extremely suspicious at the time. Like, your job consists of taking the money and putting this other account. But now I've seen, like last month, a sophisticated version of that. And our education was focused on, because I've seen a network recently targeting students, so they obtain the students, the emails, addresses of these students in the UK, they send them an email, they offer them a job from a well-known company. You see the LinkedIn profile there, HR is also much believable than before, and the work is a work that you believe on, and then the way they get the money is that they gave them a bank account of the victim, and they say, can you buy all your devices that you like, any laptops, watches, last generation, we like to support our staff, and then they go to buy it, and then they say, can you send it to this address, because we need to set it, and then it's all a lie. So I've seen that these victims, or these students who are involved, that in the past could be even considered, you know, culprit of a wrongdoing because they were collaborating, or because they were supposed not to believe on these things and not to get into these schemes. And I've seen them more reactive, checking that you can see that they have learned from the campaigns that I've seen or even I've been contributing to, in terms of this feels weird, I'm gonna actually contact another person from this company. But of course there is a lot to do, but we were focusing on that. But I think it's really, really interesting focusing on where this starts and like you said, really understand for certain types of crimes, because of course cybercrime, we've got from the type of crime that we are talking to, child abuse and pornography, so that would be completely different profile of perpetrators and a different probably way to treat this to avoid that to happen at first instance. But I really think it's very interesting and angle, and I think it's possible. It's really possible because it's been done to a certain extent in the past, like I said, with hackers, and I think probably hard work, but not impossible. I like to believe that that's something that we can all achieve.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the education is a big part of it, partly because I now, whenever I get any unsolicited message, be it on LinkedIn or email or anything like that, I'm instantly suspicious. You know, I don't trust anything these days, which is a certain amount, but I think I need to be a bit more nuanced, because I'm sure I've turned down opportunities because I thought, no, that just doesn't look quite right. Why would somebody be offering me that? Or you know, why would somebody want to connect? Because I think as well, there is that growing sophistication, but even so, there's some education to be done about spotting a wrong one, though it is definitely getting harder. But the one thing I wanted to ask was, and maybe to close up the discussion, is just about timing, just because legislation takes a while to draft and enact and things. So is that part of the problem here? Are they looking for other drivers, other measures, so it doesn't rely on those national government, national legislative bodies getting their act together and doing this?
A key thing in the policy toolkit that we're working on right now has been to address that timing. We're trying to build in adaptability mechanisms and assessment mechanisms into what we're recommending for policymakers. So basically the idea is, if the policy responses you have to cybercriminality are constantly taking into account, you know, is what we're doing working, and having clear metrics around that and taking a look at that, and then are actually able to adapt to it and be agile instead of going through the lengthy legislation process. Are there other adaptability mechanisms that can be built in? That's one way that we're finding can be helpful to go around the lengthy legislation process.
Yeah, because I think they definitely need those mechanisms, just to, because I think, as Rashi said, the bad guys, unfortunately, they're well financed, they're well motivated, they do their research, they're innovative, they, you know, always coming up with novel ways to catch people out, for sure. Yeah, so I think as well, I was just curious about sort of, if, because you mentioned metrics and measurement, and are the measures of success? I don't know if there's, you know, there's another stage of this that the commission's looking for, just to say yes, we've had an effect, or whether it does come down to those policy decisions being made in some of those nations involved.
Yeah, great question, Mark. One of the findings that we've got is that a very small percentage of cyber crimes are ever actually reported, which confounds any efforts that may be made to try to understand, or is growing, not growing. Some estimates are 5% or so of all cyber crimes are actually reported or known by law enforcement. So there is one effort to try to understand, well, what would help to organizations, individuals, to report all of the cyber crimes that they're becoming victims of. There's another European Commission program that is just aimed exactly at that, called cyberspace. It's just getting started now and is also underway exploring some of those topics. But I think my key takeaway is that there are things that we can do today. There are things that are going to take several months. Some will take several years, but we need to be working on all of those fronts, hopefully in a coordinated fashion, so that things that we could do with a short-term impact make a small difference, well, let's do those. And other things that take a little bit longer, well, let's do those too. And, you know, ultimately, this is a long-term engagement. We need to structurally address some of the issues that are out there that have been mentioned on the call here. And so one of the great things for me is having been part of this program has given me insight into all kinds of things that I didn't know about and that are actually part of making this a better world. So, you know, if we can contribute more, we will.
Yeah, it sounds like a great idea. Cause certainly there seems to be, I think you're right, there's a lot of, it's a massive iceberg of cybercrime out there. If you, you know, stop people in the street, you know, and everybody I'm sure has been touched by it one way or another. But thank you everybody for your time today, for contributing. And thank you for listening as well. You can find more podcasts on the ISF podcast channel or at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research, tools and guidance.